Welcome to This Is Money in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside editor Simon Lamb and I today is reporter Grace Gorsden. And coming up, we turn up the heat and talk energy. The government wants to scrap gas boilers in new homes by 2025, but what are the viable alternatives and just how much will they cost? Also today, Alexa, what time of day will my energy be cheapest? Octopus teams up with Amazon and will pay customers to use electricity at off-peak periods. Sound too good to be true? We teach you the tips of a successful haggle, have a moan about smart meters, and find out which energy firm we're leaving en masse. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. Giving you 100% security for your savings, backed by HM Treasury.
But first, now remember last week we were dissecting the Chancellor's spring statement, and in amongst the many words, not a lot of substance speech, was the news that gas boilers would be banned from new build homes from 2025. Good news for the environment, but potentially bad news for our wallets. Now, it had been speculated the move would cost about £5,000, add about £5,000 to the price of a house. We don't actually know that for sure because, well, the government doesn't exactly know what should replace gas boilers. So This Is Money have gone through some of the options for heating your home, like using soil in your garden. Simon, if you would, jog our memories from just a week ago.
Well, just over a week ago, we had the extremely exciting spring statement from Chancellor Philip Hammond, where he stood up and talked to us for a very long time.
If you do want to listen to that, it is last week's podcast. Do listen back. We don't just talk about gas boilers.
Yes, but there was a couple of interesting things in there. And one of the big headlines that came out of there was the announcement that all new homes from 2025, we should stop installing gas boilers for hot water and central heating, which led to the obvious question from any number of people, including, I believe, your mother.
Yes.
Well, what are they going to replace it with? And the government being the government and having its hands tied up with other things didn't actually put out anything alongside said spring statement specifying what they were going to replace it with. Fortunately, however, we did some digging, a couple of our colleagues, and we have a story looking at the different ways that you can heat your home renewably.
And all pun intended as well.
Yeah,
digging.
Some digging.
I
so
like that.
We have the ground source heat pump. We have the air source heat pump.
Right.
We have the water source heat pump.
Okay.
Notice a pattern there.
Yes.
All involving a pump, a source of heat. A source of heat, which is coming from outside the home. So either from the air, from the water, or from the ground. Then we also have solar panels. People should be familiar with those. And also a biomass boiler. So similar to a gas boiler, but doesn't use gas. Instead, you burn pellets from a renewable source. And the key to the ground, water and air source heat pumps is, if you think about it, they're taking this warmth, but the air, the ground and the water aren't really that warm, are they? But through a clever piece of technology, effectively they draw that source and then they compress it, and the act of compressing it draws the energy from it. It heats it up. If you think about, if you were to you can probably try this experiment at home with some kind of DIY school
sounds
child
really
type, you know, energy kit where you squeeze something. You will get a heat energy from it, and then you use that to pump heat around your home.
Don't give the government ideas. You know, get your kids to do a science experiment because we don't know. I mean, that's how it sounds. So, Grace, Simon's just outlined some of the alternatives. Look, how viable are they? Give it to us in a little bit more detail. How much this could add onto the price of a new home? I was about to say it sounds extraordinary that the government's come up with a proposal without a clear plan. But it does seem rather extraordinary we're in this situation that This Is Money have had to propose five suggestions for heating your home.
No, absolutely. I think it's great the government are actually doing something towards, you know, making greener homes and helping the environment. But not giving, you know, actual alternatives is not particularly helpful. The options that we've just been through are all, you know, great options. It's good that there even are options, you know.
Well, yes, we like warm homes and warm showers, don't we?
Absolutely. Yeah. The problem is the price of these things.
Okay.
For a lot of them, installation can cost between £10,000 to £25,000. And this includes digging up your garden. installing, you know, pipes that will then run through your garden into your home. It's a big ask. It's a lot of work. And for many people, it's not going to actually be worth spending thousands to just get, say, £300 a year off your energy bills.
Yeah. To be clear, though, I mean, that is if you are making that decision yourself. But for
absolutely.
All new build homes, isn't the government saying that if you have a new, you can't have a gas boiler, you have to have one of these? Well, they're not saying one of these options. They haven't said what options. They're just saying you can't have a gas boiler. So actually, it would go on to those companies that are building the homes. However, where is that money going to come from? It's going to be from the people buying, essentially. So whatever, whether you're doing it yourself or a building group is going to do it, you will have to pay somewhere, right?
Yes, absolutely. There'll be some cost involved at some point. As I said, it is a good idea. And especially in new homes, that is the best way to go about this is, you know, so that someone who is already a homeowner doesn't have to go through the stress and the upheaval of having to install this into your home already. But where the money's going to come from, a lot of the subsidies that were in place from the government, for example, for installing solar panels, has been cut or reduced. So even though it's all well and good saying we will do this, if you're going to take away the incentives for normal people, it doesn't really make much sense. And I don't think as many people are going to be as interested in doing this sort of thing.
Well, clearly, gas boilers are not great for the environment, as you pointed out. There are five viable alternatives that are on your website. So, Simon, you've given us some of the names, but let's get some of the details. Number one, this dig deep for the heat, the earth outside your home. Look, how's it going to work?
Well, I think probably we can lump the air source heat pump, the water source heat pump, and the ground source heat pump into the same sort of bracket here,
right,
in that they are all trying to draw on a different source. And so the ground source one, for example, it means digging 4 foot deep trenches, laying pipes that contain a fluid. The fluid in the pipes is warmed by the underground soil, where the temperature in the ground, even when it's freezing outside, is generally about 6 to 12 degrees centigrade. So that's why you go down into the earth. Now, I've got an element of this that I experience in my home. I live in a flat. It's a maisonette, but it's the ground floor and the lower ground floor. Our bedrooms are on the lower ground floor. And the great advantage of that is that it's warmer in winter and cooler in summer. So the temperature is pretty much regular the whole way through the year, and you don't need anywhere near as much heating down there. And, you know, that's literally just a bedroom down into the ground, so a lower ground floor level. So if you put these pipes containing this fluid into the ground, they get warmed up by the earth, but they're only warmed up, as we just said, to about 6 to 12 degrees centigrade. Which I think most people, if their home was warm to 6 to 12 degrees centigrade, or they got in the shower and the water was only 6 to 12 degrees centigrade, might have something to say about the matter. So what do you do with this water? Well, essentially, you squeeze the energy out of this very large amount of tepid water. You use a process called compression. What that does is heats it up, and then you start to flow that around the house and you use that for your heating or for your hot water. Similarly, you draw with the air source heat pump. That takes air from outside with a special fan, and it's described here in the article as working like a fridge in reverse. So instead of taking the air and making it cold on the inside, you're taking the air and making it warm on the inside. Again, you can take heat energy from the air, even if the temperature is as low as minus 15 degrees centigrade outside. Most people aren't going to want to heat their home to minus 15.
Yeah.
They're going to want it to be a bit warmer than that. Using a similar system to with the ground source heat pump, you compress it. That compressed heat is then pumped through the water, heats up the house. Water sources, again, similar thing, but this time you need a source of water near your house. So a river, a lake, or something like that. You get the water, the pipe the water from there. That water is going to be a certain temperature, not going to be hot enough to heat your house. Use that to generate the energy that then heats your home. Now, the problem with all of these things, as we just talked about, is if you want to retrofit them to your house, it is expensive. If you fit them to a new house, it is considerably less expensive. So they thought it was, they said it'd add about $5,000 to the cost of a new home. I mean, that's obviously going to depend on the size of the house. But just to put some of these figures into perspective, fitting an air source heat pump, you're looking at about £8,000. fitting a water source heat pump, you're looking at about £6,000.
Are you talking about new or retrospective?
That's retrospective.
Okay, right.
And installing a ground source heat pump, because it involves major excavation work and potentially some stuff around your house, you're looking at £10,000 to £20,000. Now, the incentive to do this isn't great, because compared to having your gas boiler on your energy bills, you're only going to save about £300 a year. It's going to take you a lot of years to get back to the money that you've spent. You get a renewable heat incentive grant worth on average £2,500 a year for the first 7 years, which obviously bumps up that return, which is why the government wants to get them into houses from the point when they're built.
What about if you were to then sell your house? Do you think it would add anything to the value of your home, with the idea that in the future the government may demand that people install these? Or do you think that actually just there is, financially speaking, I mean, if you want to do it for the environment, good for you, but actually financially speaking, it's probably...
Personally, I think that it would be relatively attractive to me, but then I'm quite interested in trying to be more green. From a money-saving point of view, I don't think that the amount of money that you would be saving over a traditional gas boiler would be enough to swing it if you were buying a home. I think the only issue is it's seen as unusual, and when something is seen as unusual to a prospective buyer of a home, that can put them off. I imagine that if you asked 100 people whether they'd prefer to have a home with a gas boiler, which is something they're comfortable with, you know, if it packs up, it's expensive, but it's not that expensive. It's a knowable expense kind of thing. There are plenty of plumbers out there. You know, try and find one when your heating stops working on the 1st of November, but there are plenty of plumbers out there. Whereas if you said to them ground source heat pump, they'd be like, well, sounds like trouble if it packs up or something goes wrong. I think one of the most interesting ones in years to come, considering that most of the houses that people live in are already built. We don't do a lot of knocking houses down and building new ones in this country. One of the big problems we have with energy efficiency is that a huge number of people in the country live in Victorian houses, and there's only so much you can do to a Victorian house unless you start putting cladding on the outside of them, and that somewhat ruins the look. So the really interesting one is solar power for people, because at the moment, realistically, the money you're going to save depends on how long you're in during the day. So the energy saving trust figures are something like £210 if you're in all day long, £90 if you're out until 6 p.m. What changes the game on that is the ability to store the energy. And the key to that is batteries. Now, batteries are a pretty unsophisticated technology in the main for most uses at the moment. Technology has accelerated at a far faster pace than batteries. But there is a huge amount of work going into trying to get better batteries at the moment. And that is related to things as diverse as smartphones, cars, hugely important, obviously, and a massive drive to do that. And also to do with solar energy. And our good friend Elon Musk is a big one for this. He is trying to develop next generation batteries that mean that you would be able to buy your solar panels, but also buy a battery installation that you then can charge up with your solar power, and then you draw on it when you need it. And that suddenly starts to be a lot more of a money saver for people. And also just, I think, to be a lot more attractive to people, and means that with these subsidies being cut, the subsidies become less important.
Now, talking about protecting the environment and our wallets, energy firm Octopus is partnering with Amazon's virtual assistant Alexa to help customers control usage. Now, this includes figuring out what time of day their electricity will be cheapest. Agile Octopus, it's called, works by offering access to half-hourly energy prices, which are tied to wholesale prices and are updated daily. It gives customers the option that they can get text messages whenever the prices drop below zero, where they will then be paid to use energy. Grace, tell us a bit more about this. It sounds too good to be true. It also sounds a little bit Big Brotherish.
Both.
Okay.
In many ways, it is too good to be true. So how it works with texting customers is when there is more electricity being generated than is being consumed, which means that suppliers are actually paid to take energy off the grid. And Octopus Energy are moving to pass this payment to customers. So they will give you a text alert that says, if you use your energy now, we are actually going to pay you to use it. However, as you can imagine, this isn't always at the most convenient times for people. It's not when you come in at 6 o'clock after work. Yeah. It's usually going to be between 2 a.m., 3 a.m., where you're likely not going to be wanting to, you know, do your washing.
So just to be clear, the price will always stay the same, but they might give you a little bit of money back, or they're paying you enough and more to cover what this would normally cost you.
I think on this one, they are taking...
So it's not quite dynamic pricing that changes. The price will stay the same. They will just give you a bit of money back should you use it at a time that's completely inconvenient to you, which is why it's cheaper at that stage. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah. If you think about your energy bill cumulatively rolling up on a sort of pretty much constant basis, well, if you use some energy at one of these times, i.e. between 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, your energy bill will start rolling back slightly. So you're not going to get to the point where you don't have an energy bill, but you might get to the point where your energy bill is £2 cheaper than it would have been otherwise because you used your washing machine between 2 and 3 in the morning.
You could actually just earn money. No, that's not what we're saying. We're not saying you can actually earn money for using your washing machine at a completely inappropriate time. When we talk about dynamic pricing, this is sort of where we go with this. But the worry I have is, people know when you're in, people know when you're using it. And what's Alexa got to do with anything?
Well, so basically where Alexa comes in is customers can ask Alexa and say, Alexa, what time of day is my electricity going to be cheapest? So it will give you an answer depending on the day, depending on when wholesale costs are cheapest, highest. And then you can make the decision whether actually I'm going to do some of my more heavy energy usage. For example, if you were going to charge an electric car, you could do it in the time it says it's going to be cheapest in the day. As you said, though, bit Big Brother-ish. And I think one of the concerns that customers will have is that, yes, it will know when it's cheapest, but it may also know when it's going to be most expensive. And suppliers could potentially use that to their advantage. Not saying they will, but it's going to be a concern for many people who have trust issues with smart meters.
Well, firstly, Alexa isn't allowed in my home, because I don't want a device listening to me all of the time, whoever is providing it. And even if it does allow me to... Alexa, I think, is largely for people who can't be bothered to Google things. Now, obviously, Google's spying on you anyway when you Google things, but it's not listening to you constantly, apparently. But you can see how, going on this theme of the future of energy that we started off with, you could see how this is the future of energy usage, because this whole Internet of Things that we keep hearing about, and everyone says, yeah, but what actually is the Internet of Things? It's everything being connected in a way and being smart. Mm-hmm. And so you could have a washing machine in 5 years' time that you put your washing into and you program it to come on, but the washing machine just comes on when the energy is cheapest. So you don't put it on in the morning and then take the washing out of the machine when it's done. You put it on and it just waits and it waits and it waits, and then it kicks in when it's cheapest to run. Electric cars, again, as Grace mentioned, you plug your car in when you come home from work, and at some point between when you come home from work and when you go to work in the morning, the energy is going to get cheaper. Maybe it even gets so cheap that you get paid to use it. And the car just kicks in, takes a bit of juice out of the grid, and then it's got it stored there. And then off you go. And the key to this, of course, is what we were talking about with the solar panels, is the fact that this energy is being generated, renewable energy is being generated, but we can't store it. So this is one of the problems with renewable energy, which at times goes above 50% of the energy being generated, is that the energy is coming in from the wind, from the sun, but we've got no way of storing it. So it has to be going into the grid. But you need to keep the other energy going, for example, the coal-powered stuff, the gas-powered stuff, because when the renewable energy drops, you still need energy coming in. If we were able to store this energy, then it wouldn't be such of a problem. And I think this is where people are going to have this big problem with the Internet of Things and with everything else, is there is a little bit too much of they just know what I'm doing all the time. But as I said, maybe they just know what we're doing all the time anyway.
Well, probably. But I do wonder about if everybody has got this Internet of Things and washing machines come on when things are cheaper, surely we'll just equalise out the price anyway. There won't be times
this
when...
This would seem to be the obvious end point, is if enough people's cars are plugged in to kick on between 2 and 3 in the morning when they get paid to be using energy, they would no longer get paid to be using energy because there would be a big draw on the grid. But I suppose if everything's connected, you know that classic spike of half-time in the football match when everybody sticks the kettle on and there's this massive draw in power? It's a genuine phenomenon. You get spikes, and what this does is evens that out. And so if everything was all connected up and doing things as smart as it could be, you just get a steady stream of energy use.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
Now, we said we'd talk about smart meters, but what is more dumb? The smart meters that don't actually work properly, or the companies that keep offering them? Yes, energy firms were expected to stop offering customers first-generation meters, known as SMETS 1, from March the 15th, as they often stopped working when you switch suppliers. Bit of a problem with that. But British Gas, SSE, EDF Energy, E.ON, Empower and Scottish Power have all confirmed they are still installing them. Which sounds a bit stupid, Grace. Firstly, what is the issue with smart meters, the government rollout?
So there's been numerous problems with smart meters. There's been a lack of trust in them. A lot of people don't think they actually work.
What are they?
They basically attach to your, you know, your central energy system, and it monitors how much you are actually using. It's meant to give you a much more accurate and fair bill and to stop, you know, wildly overestimated bills being handed out to people.
So kind of similar to what we were talking about earlier, in that companies knowing more about what we're spending and when, etc. Right.
One of the problems people think they're being spied on. You know, they've had this rollout. They are telling people this is the best thing for you. You will be saving money if you have a smart meter installed. And a lot of people have the in-home displays, which is a little screen you have in your kitchen or wherever you want to keep it, that shows you how much pounds and pence you are using every day. So you can, when you're boiling the kettle, actually see how much in real time that is costing you.
Whatever floats your boat, I suppose. Yeah.
Exactly. But as you mentioned, the first generation of smart meters, they have been flawed from the beginning. One of the main problems is when people are looking to switch supplier provider, they then go dumb, which means they lose all of their functionality and that they have absolutely no use at all. So then people have, you know, gone to their energy companies and said, I want another one. Or the second generation of smart meters, which were meant to be rolled out, but as yet have not, which are meant to make switching between suppliers so much easier. It's meant to be a smooth process and something that customers don't have to worry about anymore. But now that the Big Six have confirmed, they are not installing second generations. They're still installing first generations.
Why? What's their justification for that?
It's difficult to say. I've had a lot of reader complaints about this.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people who don't want smart meters to begin with, and it feels like the government is sometimes forcing you to have them. But the people who actually want a smart meter are stuck with a first generation, can't get a second generation. And it's just all a big mess. It seems ridiculous. Not enough people are taking up the smart meters as the government want. They want everyone to have a smart meter, every household, every small business to have one by next year. It's not happening.
We're way off course, aren't we?
Way off target, way off course. I can't say whether it was a realistic aim or not, but with all the problems that have been reported, it's no surprise people don't want to have them installed. And I think that is part of the problem. The uptake has not been as expected or as targeted.
It's also an issue as well, as given that this has taken such a long time, given the fact that, you know, the SMETS 1 was pretty bunk, let's be honest. By the time we've got the full SMETS 2 rollout, as Simon's been talking about the Internet of Things, surely there's going to be something, you know, we'll have it all from our smartphones. Why do we need all these machines being installed in our house?
Absolutely. It goes back to the being spied on, the Big Brother thing. People think that energy companies may use smart meters almost in their advantage. They will be able to see when you're in, when you're using the most energy, at what time. And then there's the concern that, you know, prices may reflect that. Prices are going to be more expensive for you when they know you're using the most. Mm. Not saying whether that's true or not, but that's definitely a concern. And as you said, there's bound to be something that's not going to be quite right with this second generation. What it is, who knows? They may go dumb. There's no guarantee that they're not going to go dumb like the first generations. And they're not very clear on what the actual difference between the two is, other than they're meant to make switching suppliers easier.
But also as well, didn't they come out and say it's only going to really save on average 14 quid or 11 quid or something? And with prices of energy so bizarre, I mean, what are you actually paying that's a fair price for your energy? £14 for all that sort of thing? And the risks that are involved, that it may not work, you're left with a dumb machine. Is it still in your cupboard, Simon, by the way?
Yes, it is.
Toys?
I got a smart meter. I like my smart meter. I like the fact that when I go to look what my bill will be, or what it is, that it is actually correct. I remember previously with Npower, where even though I was paying a monthly direct debit, their wild estimations of my bill that saw me weave crazily between being in credit and being in debit were quite annoying. However, when they did fit the smart meter, they put my little energy monitor thing on the side. That's on the side in the kitchen where we normally plug in our phones or mm-hmm. things to charge. So I came home, I looked at it, I thought that's interesting. Then I unplugged it to put my phone on to charge. It went in the cupboard and it's been in the cupboard ever since. So I turned my smart meter dumb myself. But the whole point is not really to save people money on their bills. It's to get people to use less energy. And that's why the little thing on the side in the kitchen is there. It's nudge theory. So people see it and they go, oh, I'm using that much energy. I wonder if I could get that down by going and turning the lights off. But the problem is the government tried to nudge the population, and the great British population didn't just stand still. It pushed back in the other direction very firmly, largely because people don't like change. They don't want smart meters. There is this concern that once the energy companies know how people are using energy and when they're using it, they'll just bump the prices up. Energy companies have not exactly bathed themselves in glory in recent years, so quite why we should trust them, I don't know. And also the fact that, yeah, the things don't work properly. So I'm in the process of switching energy supplier. I am moving from OVO, who I've been with mm-hmm. for some time, to Bulb Energy. Now, I'm intrigued to know whether my smart meter is going to continue to be able to be used, whether I'm going to get a new smart meter, or whether they're just going to turn it off and go back to the old-fashioned click, 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 round in a circle dial meter. I'll keep you updated.
Interesting. I just want to know, Grace, who are you with?
I'm with OVO Energy also.
Goodness, because I'm with Octopus. None of the big six among us.
Well, that's good to know. It's good to know there is a move towards smaller suppliers. I know they haven't exactly had the best press, what with about 20, I would like to say, going yeah. bust within the past year or so. So there is a concern of people moving to smaller suppliers that they're going to end up back at square one anyway. But actually, it's good to see there is a general shift towards that because they are generally better with their prices. And actually, a lot of them, their customer service is really good as well.
I was going to say, for me, I really like very, very hands-on customer service. But interestingly that you say that we're all sort of moving around, because we got some numbers, didn't we, report about E.ON, yes. one of the big six. This is according to Compare the Market, who say that they're losing customers at an alarming rate. What is an alarming rate when it's at home, Grace?
An alarming rate is 21% of your customers moving to another supplier in 1 month alone.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow, in 1 month?
In 1 month, in February, the Compare the Market Energy Snapshot takes a look at all of the suppliers and their customers to see who has switched to who in the course of a month. And it found out that E.ON had the biggest loss of customers out of all of the suppliers, big six and small, at 21%. I believe 7% switched to, but that's still a net loss then of 14%, which is huge for a big six company.
The small suppliers, there's a really interesting chart that Ofgem puts out that shows the market share of the companies, and we've used it in a number of articles before. We'll get it up on the site again. But the big six still have a huge chunk of the market, but there's a sort of next tier, the companies like OVO, like First Utility, like Octopus as well, that are coming up hard on their heels behind them. And some of those big six companies, E.ON, as we mentioned, are losing customers at a pretty rapid rate.
Is that where they're going, though? Are they going to this next tier, or are they going to the other big six?
I think a lot of them are going to the next tier. Quite a few of them have gone to some of the smaller ones, but there's just so many of the smaller ones that their market share is relatively small, although it's getting a little bit bigger for some of them as others go bust, as Grace said. I think people have wised up to the idea that actually your energy is your energy is your energy. There is this system whereby if your energy supplier does go bust, you don't suddenly lose all your electricity and gas. You just get put onto another one. Effectively, a lot of these very small energy companies are just middlemen. But I think also they're going, well, I don't like what the big six have done. I'm going to the smaller ones. But also they're doing some stuff like I've done, which is my electricity is 100% green, 100% renewable electricity. I tell you one thing, though, that is causing a major headache amongst this smart meter thing and switching energy suppliers is all of the people renting. Realistically, as a tenant, you need to be getting the landlord's permission if you're not to switch energy supplier, but if the energy supplier wants to come and put a smart meter in. And it can, from the tenant's point of view, obviously, if you need to get a smart meter to get the best deal, you want to get a smart meter. But you also have to look at it from the landlord's point of view, that this can be a massive headache for them when the next person moves in and wants to switch their energy bills and they've got the wrong smart meter involved and everything like that. So this is one of the reasons why, going back to this dumb smart meter thing, they really need to sort this out, because there's a huge number of people who rent in this country. And the fact that in order to switch energy suppliers, they'd have to get the smart meter replaced, turn the smart meter off, do all these other things, causes a big headache for them.
I do want to bookend that subject, the smart meter one, with the fact that you can actually, or you should actually request, if you do have one installed, that it is a SMETS 2, yes?
Yes.
Okay, so with E.ON specifically, one of the main problems, I would say, that they are losing customers is to do with the whole smart meter debacle. Fixed tariff customers can now only sign up to the cheapest options if they agree to have a smart meter installed, which many people are saying is blackmail. It's bribery.
Because you don't have to. We've said this on the podcast in the past.
Legally,
it's up
you don't
to
have
you.
To. Absolutely. So I've received so many emails, as I think many of us have, about E.ON in particular. There isn't a single fixed tariff on their site you can change to without agreeing to have a smart meter installed. You know, if it's still a choice, it's not a legal requirement, you should make other options available to other people. And this has really angered a lot of people.
Do you think, Simon, that's the reason E.ON have seen such a... That and the fact we spoke about perhaps cheaper options and, you know, the next tier down...
Yeah, I think all of those things together are amongst the reasons
customer
that
service,
they're suffering.
All of the
big six are suffering on customer numbers. It's not just them, but they're suffering particularly.
All right, well, Simon, you spoke about, you know, using things like smart meters and more technological ways of saving money. Well, let's go back to the old school. Have you ever haggled on a bill? I have. Generally on behalf of my father. If not, why not? Especially when it comes to broadband, because there is a new study which shows the providers where existing customers are most likely to be successful when they try and haggle for a better deal. It doesn't seem very British, does it, Grace, to haggle for a deal? But you would be really wise to, wouldn't you?
You would. It's definitely something I think people feel awkward about doing. I have done it, but, you know, working up the courage to pick up the phone and say, oh, actually, I'm not really happy with this. And I think, you know, the person next door is getting it a bit cheaper, so why can't I? That sort of thing. People do have a bit of a fear about it, but really it is so worth your time doing. So this study looked at some of the major broadband providers and asked their customers how happy they were with the service they received when they tried to haggle their bill down. TalkTalk came out on top. 80% of people said they were really happy with the response. Actually, who came last was Virgin Media, with 34% of people not even receiving a reply.
Ooh, that's not good.
That's not good. That's not good customer service at all. And TalkTalk, one of the reasons they said that they were, you know, so successful with their customers were happy with them, was because they are one of the only broadband providers, according to them, that support, you know, the CMA is investigation into loyalty penalties, which happened recently.
Right, I'm going to play devil's advocate, as you know I want to do. But does that not just mean that their prices are just arbitrary? They say they support the loyalty. Well, they support the loyalty if you have the gumption to call them up and ask for a better deal. And if they're that quick to respond and say, well, actually, we can offer you, my thinking with that would be, well, you're screwing everyone else over still who doesn't have the, you know, about to say a rude word there, the gumption to call up and ask for it. I mean, I'm a big haggler. I've got no problems with that. I went into Curry's PC World the other day and managed to haggle a couple of hundred quid off a new computer because I've got no problems with that. But there are plenty of people that do have a problem with it. So I would say to you, are TalkTalk overpricing everybody in the view that when you call them up and you ask for a better deal, they have that leeway? Or am I just being super harsh?
Point taken. And it is a good point. I can completely understand your thinking. And maybe to a certain extent, it is that way. But then there are... What would you rather? A company that you ring up and they actually say, yeah, you can have some money off. Or a company that you ring up and say, actually, no. Because by and large, broadband providers often supply TV. They often supply phone lines. It comes in a big package. And these packages are getting more and more expensive by the day. As we've seen, Sky have increased their prices recently. And I'm sure that will be followed by a number of other companies. And they will continue to do so because they can. So I think actually, out of all the providers, if you have one, if you're with one that is willing to put the prices down, that's great. Because, for example, Virgin Media, if they're not even going to respond, it doesn't matter what their prices are. If you can't get through to anyone, what's the point?
Oh, she's so nice, isn't she, Simon? I'm just so cynical. I just think, what would I prefer? I'd prefer a company that offers a fair price for everybody.
Good luck finding one of
those.
Yeah,
it's not going to happen, to be honest.
This is why we started our Check and Challenge Your Bills campaign just before Christmas. It's because this is basically how the system works. All of the companies price like this. So they price for new customers, and then they bump up the prices as time goes on. And then what they rely on people doing is inertia, not challenging their bills. And most people probably end up paying quite a bit of money for their broadband and probably their TV as well nowadays, like they do for their mobile phones and so on and so on. And if you don't challenge them and say, I'm going to leave, they won't offer you a better deal because they have teams of people who work on one, working out how elastic, you know, their customers are in terms of will they shift, won't they shift. You're probably in some kind of bucket. You've been ranked 1 to 10.
Blacklist.
Is Georgie Frost likely to leave if we don't give her a better deal?
I'm high on their customer retention.
And then they have retention. They have retention teams whose job is to keep people. And what they do is they have a certain churn of customers. Some leave, some come in. And the more they can keep that down, the more money they can make. So it does work to play the game. This research was done by a company called Is My Bill Fair, which offers a service whereby you can put in your details, you can find out how much you're paying compared to other people, and then you can actually use their own system to challenge your bill, and they will fire off a letter to your provider and say, Georgie Frost is not happy with the price that she's paying, and she would like you to offer her a better deal, and they'll try and negotiate a better deal for you. Effectively, it's like a comparison thing, but it involves not having to switch supplier. The first port of call is just trying to get a better deal off the one you're with, and lots of people just can't be bothered to switch their broadband. That's why they end up paying too much money. I think one of the problems here is Virgin Media aren't necessarily engaging with the Is My Bill Fair system. So they're saying, no, we're not going to let you try and negotiate this deal for your customer. Your customer needs to speak to us direct.
Interesting. Any successful haggle tips, finally?
First and foremost, have the confidence to do it. Don't think, oh, what's the point? Oh, you know, it might not even work. Go for it. Pick up the phone, get in contact with customer service, and think about what you want out of the phone call. Think about how much realistically you would like off your bills. Also worth researching, you know, the prices they have for new customers and say, actually, I'm paying maybe 10 quid more a month than a new customer, but I've been with you for 5 years. So what can you do for me that means I'm going to stay with you for another 5 years?
Yeah, I phoned the RAC and just said, I want the new customer price. And they said, oh, we can give you... No, I want them. They gave it to me.
Breakdown cover. When we originally launched this campaign and we ran some figures, breakdown cover is one of the ones where people get stung the most. And I think that customers quite rightly think the price of breakdown cover is just the price of breakdown cover. They don't realise that there's a price being offered to new customers and a price being bumped up every year. And people stick with the AA or the RAC for years and years and years. And didn't you save your dad a load of money on the RAC?
He was paying about £276. They sent him an email, a letter saying it was going up to 290 something, 96. And I called them up and said, what's the cheapest that you're offering at the moment? 139.
Astonishing.
I mean, my dad was just couldn't believe it. I blew his mind.
I remember when we were talking about this, when we launched the campaign, and you actually, you know, offered yourself up for helping your dad for the story.
Because I didn't just stop with RAC.
Astonished at the breakdown cover one. I really was.
That was the worst. But I mean, everyone was screwing him over. by a huge amount. But that one was the one that I just couldn't get it. And the problem is you go onto a comparison website and it offers you breakdown cover for, say, £30. So imagine you're currently paying £300. You think that's very high. You look on a comparison site and think £30. Then you think, where the heck do I pitch this? Because £30 is surely too little to be paying, £300 too much. What is a reasonable... And I think a lot of people just don't know now. What is a reasonable amount I should be paying?
You have to be willing to leave and you have to be willing to switch, and you have to realise that ultimately, if you've got Virgin Media, you have to have the price of Sky in your hand when you phone up Virgin, or if you're with Sky, you have to have the price of Virgin in your hand, and you have to say to them, I am thinking of moving to Sky because they're going to offer me this deal. And then you try and get them to offer you the deal. Again, with the RAC, you've got to call them up and say, I've got this price from the AA, or I've got this price for your new customer in my hand. I am going to leave. If you don't give me this new customer price, I am going to the AA or Green Flag or something like that. And you have to be willing to do it. And you can't just go. And people do this all the time with breakdown cover. They go, yeah, but I did break down that time. And the RAC were really good. Yeah. They did come out and they did help me out. And it's like, yeah, that's what you're paying your breakdown provider for. And do you know what? If you'd have been with the AA or Green Flag or AutoAid, which I'm with, and I pay £48 a year, and that covers me and my wife in any car that we are driving, every time I've ever had to call on them, they've come out and they've rescued me, just in the same way that the RAC or the AA would have done.
All I do want to ask, though, is, I mean, you pay £48, that's very good, but if you don't know about these sorts of things, and we hear stories, particularly when it comes to things like travel insurance or any sort of insurance, where policies are being hollowed out to make it the cheapest so that they can go to the top of the comparison sites, how can you trust some of these prices is what I'm suggesting?
It's difficult to know. For example, with travel insurance, there is a company called DeFacto, and they put a star rating on most websites. They have it now. I think it's from 1 to 5, simple, 5 best, 1 not the best. And it is difficult because even if you've got a 5-star cover, for example, which has, you know, all the bells and whistles on it, you might not need that. If you're not going skiing and it's got skiing cover in it, it's no good. So even though it can be time consuming, it is worth having a look through the terms and conditions for what specifically you need, as well as seeing if you can talk to someone actually at an insurance company and ask them if it's got all the things that are needed.
And if you do have an existing one you like, again, we go full circle. You haggle with them, right?
Yes. And I think Grace very politely put forward the suggestion there that what people need to do is engage their brains, is do actually think about what you will and won't use from any service that you sign up for, and then try to ascertain whether the thing you're signing up for matches your needs. Classic one with the breakdown cover that makes some breakdown cover cheaper is, if your car won't start at your home, they won't come out. You need to be a certain distance from your home. Now, if you think about all the times you've broken down and needed help, and you think, actually, a number of those were when I walked out of my house and tried to start my car, don't try and save yourself £5 to £10 a year by going for one of those.
Thank you very much. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you'd like to get in contact with us, please do, Simon.
Email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk if you've got a problem that you want us to solve or something you'd like us to investigate. Tweet us at thisismoney if you want to tell us something, or join in the conversation at thisismoney.co.uk/podcast.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings, backed by HM Treasury.